books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, Jesse Sestanto will tell us about the brand new book, You Will Never Be Me, where your follower count is more important than your family or friends. We'll also find some brand new titles entering the RNIB Talking Books library and hear from a classic narrator. All that on today's Read On. After the incredible success of Vera Wong's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers and the Dial A for Auntie series, Jesse Sestanto is back with a gripping revenge thriller about toxic friendship and the dark side of social media. When cracks start forming in an influencer's curated life, she finds out that jealousy is just as viral as a video. You Will Never Be Me is out now, and it's been described as Gone Girl if Amy Dunn was a momfluencer. And it will make you question how much you share online. I'll talk to Jessie in a moment about this and some of her other books, but for now, the audio version of You Will Never Be Me is read by Eunice Wong and Risa May.
Meredith. I'm stalking my best friend. There's no use denying it. When I first started, I told myself we were so in sync that we were like the same person torn into two halves, and those two halves were linked by an invisible thread that was always pulling us back to each other, so of course we'd constantly be running into each other. Simpatico. That's what we always used to say. Simpatico. Followed by a wink, content and smug, because out of almost 8 billion humans in the world, the two of us somehow managed to find our soulmates in each other. And what is that if not pure and beautiful magic? And anyway, it's not really stalking, not like the kind you see in the movies with the stalker prowling in all black. Contrary to popular belief, black is not for everyone. It certainly does my skin tone no favors. A chloroform-soaked rag in one hand and zip ties in the other. I'm not trying to kidnap Bestie. It's more like stalking light. I just want to know how she's doing. I need to see if our earth-shattering fight mauled her the way it did me. That's reasonable. And I sure as hell won't find out anything through her social media accounts, which are all glossed over with giddily jubilant content. No, if I want to see signs of the wreckage underneath, I need to see her in person, catch a glimpse of the tightness around the right corner of her mouth, or the way she licks her lips like a lizard does, a rapid twitch that does nothing to moisten them. And that's why I'm sitting in a car around the corner from the twins' school, waiting for her car to appear out of the drop-off line. Damn it, I know it sounds bad. I'm literally parked outside of her kid's school. But this has nothing to do with her girls, even though I miss Noemi and Alea so much. And I'm sure they must miss Aunt Mare. And Luca misses little Sabine. Don't you, Luca? I coo, glancing back at my 8-month-old son. You miss baby Sabine, don't you, sweetie?
You Will Never Be Me is about two momfluencers. That's mom influencers for those who are lucky enough to have not been exposed to that term. They used to be best friends, but one of them surpassed the other, which led to a falling out. Then this kind of like turned into a really toxic friendship, you know, with social media thrown into the mix and results in a murder.
Aspen. It is not yet 9 in the morning, and I've almost snapped at Alea 3 separate times. The first was when I was trying to get a photo of the beautiful stack of sourdough pancakes to post to my stories, and she stabbed her fork through it before I said they were okay to eat. She totally knew what she was doing, too. I could tell from that glint in her eyes. Taking a deep breath, I said, "Sweetheart, wait, please." And she moaned. "But Mommy, I'm hungry, and Noemi's blood sugar is probably getting low."
Now, Aspen and Meredith are both kind of unlikable in their own ways. Two questions. Do you have a favorite, and was it hard to write people like that?
No, it's okay. So it's not at all hard to write them because I love unlikable female characters. Those are my favorite characters to read about and to write. And I would have to say my favorite character to write was Aspen. I can't give away too much, but I love writing her.
I'm very aware that we're dancing around spoiler territory, so
Let's
look at the bigger picture. The book kind of looks into, well, one of the aspects is it looks into the depression that can come from social media. Like, no one liked my Twitter posts. What am I doing wrong? Do you think that's a real problem?
So I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, it was definitely a real problem because it took me almost 10 years to get a publishing deal. And that whole time I was writing and just getting rejected by every publisher. And meanwhile, I would look at Facebook, which is kind of giving away how old I am. But yeah, I would look at Facebook and I'd be like, oh my gosh, all of my friends are doing so well, you know, they're just off doing amazing things. And here I am just failing at life. And it really became very unhealthy for me.
Is that why you've been such a prolific author in the last few years? You've got all these drafts in a drawer?
Pretty much. Yeah, because it took me so long to get published, I had to learn to write really fast. And then as soon as I got done writing a book, I would move on to the next one just to kind of like fall in love with a new project. So I wasn't so hung up on the current one that might then go on to not sell to publishers. So because of that, like I learned to write super fast.
Now, looking back at the world of momfluencers, I can't say that word, momfluencers. Looking back upon the world of maternal influencers, how much of their output do you think is fake?
Gosh, okay, so this was partly inspired by an article I read, and it was titled something like, "I'm Leaving My Wife Because of Aesthetics." And reading the title, I was like, what? That sounds really horrible. But then I read the article. And so this man, he was talking about how his wife started an Instagram account when she got pregnant, and then it grew really quickly. And then soon their life was just governed by aesthetics. And he felt like everything they did was fake. You know, she even faked their baby, like standing up for the first time, because she didn't actually catch it on camera when the baby did actually stand up for the first time, but she did it again for her followers. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I need to write about this. So my guess would be that a lot of it is fake.
Yeah, there is a scene in the book where
the
husband gets in the shot of the baby taking the first steps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What social media do you use now?
So I'm mostly on Instagram. I tried using TikTok, but I think it moves a little bit too fast for me.
I have looked at the post you made, "Write a book with me in 5 weeks." What sort of feedback have you been getting from that?
It's been really positive on the whole. People have talked about how they tried some of the methods that I've shared, the most popular one being the 15-minute writing sprint. So it's where I set a timer for 15 minutes. And during those 15 minutes, I'm not allowed to do anything aside from writing. So I'm not allowed to delete things that I write. I'm not even allowed to take a sip of my coffee. It's just, you know, pure writing without stopping. And this really allows me to kind of turn off that critical part of my brain that's just going, you know, oh, this is crap. What are you doing? This doesn't make any sense. And people have told me that they tried it, they were really skeptical, and then they find that it works really well for them. So yeah, I've been really happy with the feedback.
Sometimes when you're writing like that, you get into a place where you're kind of zoned out. It's just you and the keyboard. If the 15-minute alarm goes off and you're in mm-hmm. that mood, do you force yourself to stop or do you just keep going?
Mm-hmm. When the timer goes off, I have to like pause. And then if I am in the zone, then I just start another 15-minute timer and then I go again immediately. But most of the time I do stop and then I take a break. You know, I sit back and sip my coffee and kind of gather my thoughts. And then I start another 15-minute timer.
Maybe I should drive home. What the hell was I thinking? But just then, I spotted her SUV pulling out of the school driveway. My breath catches in my throat, emotion welling up at the painfully familiar sight of her car. I can practically smell the inside of her car already. Her Miss Dior perfume, the girl's raspberry shampoo and homemade kale chips. Then, as it drives past, I catch sight of her face, her eyes hidden behind her oversized Chanel sunglasses, and her hair falling in loose mahogany waves down her shoulders. And tears rush to my eyes behind my similarly oversized Jimmy Choo's. Damn it, but I miss that bitch, Aspen. A bitter snort tumbles out of my mouth at her name. Aspen. I gave that to her. What's in a name? Well, a name is the beginning of your brand, so what's in a name? Everything. In a way, you could say I made Aspen into who she is today. She owes me everything.
Now, the audio version of You Will Never Be Me is read by, what I would say, two of your constant narrators, because they've done a lot of your work, Eunice Wong and Risa May. Mm-hmm. Did you have any choice in their original casting?
I did, yes. So Eunice Wong was the voice actor behind Vera Wong. And she did, oh my God, what an amazing job she did. You know, she won all sorts of awards for it, which is so well-deserved. And I just knew, I was like, okay, I need to work with her forever. And then Risa May, she was the voice of the main character in Dial A for Aunties. And I just love her voice. It's like the sweetest, most innocent sounding voice. And I just thought, oh, she would be perfect for Aspen.
Also, one of the voices in Genshin Impact. As a gamer, you'll appreciate that.
Yeah.
Have you never thought about narrating a book yourself?
You know, one day I would love to, like, if I feel like I have enough power as an author and I can be like, hey, you know what? Guess who would be a great voice actor? Me. But I don't feel like I'm there yet.
Also in the Talking Books Library by Jesse Sertanzo is I'm Not Done With You Yet. The audiobook is narrated by Yuli Alshin, Saskia Marleveld, Liana Bertrand, and Eunice Wong.
The sky in England is different from the sky in California. It's the first thing I notice when I walk out of Heathrow. It seems lower somehow. And even though it's a beautiful English summer day with wispy white clouds frosting the deep blue sky, it feels slightly oppressive. Or maybe it's just my mood. I'm nervous. And when I'm nervous, I get cranky, which is bad, really bad, because I can't control my anger like the normals do. Mom has never bothered taking me to see anyone, because she insisted nothing was wrong with me. She'd say things like, why do white people come up with so many mental health issues? All of a sudden, everybody has mental health issues. It's all made up so they can medicate us and take our money.
Now, you've got two narrators in this book. Can we quickly talk about I'm Not Done With You Yet, which has a full cast? What was the thinking behind giving it so many voices?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So the audio book for that, I was so excited because the person in charge of it at the publishing house, she was like, so I'm thinking we're going to have four voice actors. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. That was the biggest cast I've ever had for any of my books. So I was very, very excited. And then they were just amazing. Like I listened to that one, like from start to finish. And I thought they did an incredible job
Do you listen to other audiobooks?
Yeah, so I'm so busy and overwhelmed as a mom right now that that's how I read most of my books. I listen to them on audio.
Alongside You Will Never Be Me in the RNIB Talking Books Library is Dial A for Aunties. If listeners haven't come across that one yet, can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
So Dial A for Aunties, it holds such a special place in my heart because it was the first book, like in what a lot of people call is a new genre. So it's about a young woman who accidentally kills her blind date, as you do, and then has to get the help of her very meddlesome mother and aunties to get rid of the body at the same time while catering to a billionaire's wedding. So it's like a very comedic caper with, you know, a little light murder thrown in for good measure. Yeah, I love it. It's been compared to Finley Donovan, and I love the Finley Donovan books. So yeah, it's just been a great ride.
There is a curse in my family. It's followed us all the way from China, where it took my great-grandfather. Freak accident on the farm that involved a pregnant sow and an unfortunately placed rake. To Indonesia, where it claimed my grandfather. A stroke at the age of 30. Nothing quite so dramatic as great-grandfather's demise, but still rather upsetting. My mom and aunts figured that a Chinese curse wouldn't follow them to the West, so after they all got married, they moved to San Gabriel, California. But not only did the curse find them, it mutated. Instead of killing the men in my family, it made them leave, which is so much worse. At least Ye Ye died loving my Nai Nai. The first one who left was Big Uncle. Then Second Uncle. And then it was my dad, who left without a word in the dead of night, just up and disappeared like a ghost. I woke up one morning, asked where he was, and Ma slapped down a bowl of congee and said, "Eat."
Now, a wedding in Scotland or in the UK, 200's a lot of people for a UK wedding. Are there really weddings with 2,000?
Oh, yeah. So my husband is actually, he's English. So when we got married, we had a wedding in Indonesia. So the average size of the wedding here is 2,000. But because my husband, so, you know, you usually get like 1,000 from the bride's side and then 1,000 from the groom's side. But my husband did not know 1,000 people. So, you know, he had 7. And so my parents were like, "Oh my God, we need to invite more people." So we managed to get it up to like 1,500. And it was so difficult finding a ballroom that was smaller because all of them had been kind of designed with 2,000 guests in mind. And the wedding planner was like, "Oh, this is going to look too empty." And she was like, "This is a real problem. Can we just partition off like a part of the ballroom, you know, so it looks more like lively?" And it was a real issue for us.
In research, I've seen you both referred to as Jesse Q Sutanto and Jesse Sutanto alone. Have they dropped the Q in the UK?
Yes, they have. We had an actual discussion about it where they were like, "This is just not very common in the UK. So can we drop it, please?" And I was like, "Really? You don't think it would be kind of confusing?" And they were like, no, we promise you." So, I mean, it wasn't a big deal for me because I never, who uses their middle name ever, right? So I was okay with that.
Now, finally, one thing we'll miss when we download You Will Never Be Me from the RNIB Talking Books Library is the cover. Could you give us a little description of the book cover?
Oh, yeah. So I have to admit that I really hate adult thriller covers. To me, I really just, like, they don't catch my eye. So I was really prepared to kind of hate whatever cover they came up with. But then they sent the cover to me and I was like, oh my God, it's perfect. No, it's, you know, I was so happy with it. So it shows a woman. I mean, you don't know if it's Aspen or Meredith. And she's standing behind a ring light, which I thought was just so perfect because of like the whole social media aspect. And I thought, wow, they really hit that out of the park.
So, Jesse, with a cue or without a cue, Susanto, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
I give her a kind smile. I'm gracious, generous. I like to help. There's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women, etc. When she sees my smile, the relief that goes through her face is that of a drowning person who's just been thrown a lifeline. I go to her. Pause for a second. I need you to fully understand what a huge favor I'm doing here. Because the other thing is that I'm Asian. But she looks very clearly like an Asian person from Asia, and not even the right parts of Asia, not the ones that inspire weeaboos or koreaboos. I was born and raised in Ohio, and I had to learn a long time ago how to fit in, which parts of my Asianness to highlight and which ones to hide. One of the things I quickly learned to do was to dissociate from other Asians who weren't conforming. It might sound cruel, but know what else is cruel? High school kids in Ohio. It was a long and brutal road for me to become the right kind of Asian, the kind that doesn't bring anything with a face on it for lunch. One time, Raj Singh's mom packed him a fish head curry in fifth grade. I looked Raj up on Twitter the other day. He is now an alcoholic. I bet I can trace everything that went wrong in his life back to that fish head curry. It smelled dope, though. I'll give his mom that.
You Will Never Be Me by Jesse Sustanto, narrated by Eunice Wong and Risa May, is available commercially now. And thanks to HQ, should be on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it will join many other of Jesse's books. And Jesse will be back at the end of the show for the books of her life.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now on Read On, it's time to take our first trip to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
A Talent for Murder by Peter Swanson was given to us by Faber and Faber.
Martha said yes to Alan when he returned from his trip. She told herself she wouldn't be completely giving up her independent life. Alan traveled so much for work that she'd have plenty of time alone. They honeymooned in London, Alan making a list of pubs he wanted to visit. He had a passion for beer, and Martha was happy to go along. Toward the end of that trip, they'd visited an elegant Victorian pub during a rainy afternoon. Martha studying her Fodor's travel guide, while Alan leaned against the elaborate bar, chatting with the bartender. She watched him, his loud American voice at odds with the quiet man behind the bar, noting the way that Alan won over the reluctant Brit, who was now smiling and giving Alan tastes of the different beers they had on cask. It was at this moment that Martha had two competing thoughts. One, that she'd married a nice man, and two, that he was a complete and utter stranger to her.
After an unexpected whirlwind romance, quiet librarian Martha married Alan. But when she thinks she sees his mask slip, she starts to fear that the conferences he travels the country to attend might be a cover for something far more sinister. As she secretly starts to map his movements, she unearths a string of dead women. But could these two things really be linked? Unsure of her own instincts, Martha turns to an old friend, Lily Kintner, who once helped her escape a toxic relationship in grad school. But what Martha doesn't know is that Lily has a dark side of her own.
She realized she didn't really know him any better now than she had after that first date, when she'd returned home to her two-bedroom house in Portsmouth, and decided that if Alan wanted to see her again, she'd agree. A year later, and there were some days Martha never thought of her husband, and some days he was all she seemed to think about. It was natural, she supposed. Even though she was 39, she was still a newlywed, married less than a year. She actually hated the word newlywed, or hated other people saying it, like Donna from the library, who called her the newlywed in a wink-wink kind of way for about 6 months after she and Alan were married. Martha preferred the phrase newly married, but however you said it, that was what she was, a newly wedded person, with all that that implied. On the days she didn't think much about him, it was because of how seamlessly he'd slid into her life. Alan was a careful and predictable man, and Martha had a careful and predictable life. On the days she thought about him, it was because there was something inexplicable about his presence, something that nagged at her. Back in high school and all through college, Martha had kept a journal that was entirely made up of passages from books she loved and poems that she would copy out in her tight, cursive handwriting. She spent hours transcribing in her journal, and every once in a while she would come across a word she knew well, that would suddenly not make any sense. She'd be convinced it was spelled wrong, or completely made up by the poet or author. This never happened with a word like crepuscular, but always with a simple word like apron. Suddenly she'd be staring at it, and the word would make absolutely no sense. That was what Alan was like, a plain, even-tempered man, who sometimes made no sense.
A Talent for Murder by Peter Swanson is read by Graham Halstead, Catherine Early, Keith Sarabaya, Sophie Amos, and Stephen Graybill, and it runs for 8 hours and 24 minutes.
For cricket lovers, Bloomsbury have given us Richie Benno's Blue Suede Shoes by David Kynaston.
In cricket, as in life, Peter May and Richie Benno came from completely different hemispheres. One was a quintessential Englishman of his era, imbued with the old certainties of class, of empire, of conduct, and seldom, if ever, questioning them. The other was a quintessential Australian, imbued with an unsentimental pragmatism and capacity to take risks that, throughout his life, made him open to change. In short, two great cricketers embodying two very different cultures, sporting and otherwise. The archetypal clean-cut Englishman was how indeed one notable Australian cricket writer, David Frith, would characterise May after his death. Tall, square-shouldered, erect, slightly stiff of movement, self-effacing and taciturn, shy of smile but steely in reaction to adversity. Perhaps the only mystery about PBH May was where his cricketing talent had come from. He was born in Reading on the last day of the 1920s. His father ran the family firm of wholesale ironmongers and builders' merchants. His parents were Methodists. The young Peter grew up in a very orderly household, with handsomely bound volumes of Kipling adorning the sitting room, and, sent to board at Charterhouse in Surrey, he was a schoolboy prodigy with the bat before further great feats almost inexorably followed in the 1950s for Cambridge University, for Surrey, and, of course, for England.
August 1961, Old Trafford, Manchester. The three previous tests of the series, a draw, a win for Australia, a win for England. A wonderful snapshot of a game on cusp with everything to play for. Watching on, an entire nation sits on tenterhooks as England, led by Peter May, risk-averse and establishment-minded, seem on the verge of victory. Yet somehow, they manage to throw it all away as Australia, led by their charismatic skipper Richie Benno, storms to victory. The difference between May and Benno is highlighted the evening before, when Benno, dashing and free-thinking, strolled out to inspect the wicket wearing a pair of blue suede shoes. Such sartorial boldness would have been unthinkable from his opposite number, known for sporting a sharp blazer and cravat. Written by master historian David Kynaston and Harry Ricketts, Richie Benno's Blue Suede Shoes marks a vivid recreation of 5 days of sharply fluctuating fortunes and weaves the narrative of the match into a broader tapestry of social change in the 1960s, a time when the old amateur era of cricket is reaching its overdue end, and broader changes were afoot.
A trio of reminiscences suggests something of the person. Genuine modesty would be the admiring words of the writer Simon Raven, his contemporary at Charterhouse. So much so that, The quiet and sometimes embarrassed manner in which Peter behaved in the midst of his triumphs reminded one of the poet Horace when he disclaimed personal merit for having written his poetry and gave credit for all to his muse. Charles Williams, an Oxford Blue and subsequent historian of the passing of the amateur, recalled a modest and agreeable companion who was polite, well-mannered, but strangely inarticulate. And Mickey Stewart, a Surrey teammate, remembered someone who, as captain, struggled somewhat to connect with the professionals because he didn't have the experience of mixing with a cross-section of society. One way and another, the Peter May of the 1950s was someone very much of his time, a privately educated southerner, playing cricket as an amateur, enjoying a comfortable enough berth at Lloyd's in the City of London, and knowing little of other worlds. It is easy enough to condemn him for his lack of imagination, let alone imaginative sympathy. But in those deficiencies, he was no different from many thousands of upper-middle-class Englishmen of arguably any era, let alone his.
Richie Benaud's Blue Suede Shoes, the story of an Ashes classic by David Kinnison, is read by David Thorpe and runs for 9 hours and 6 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Still to come, more brand new books in the RNIB library and The Books of Your Life from Jesse Satanto. But next, there's always some good feedback when we hear from one of our classic narrators. On our sister show, Talking Books, I've played many a P.G. Wodehouse title, narrated by Bruce Montagu. Bruce unfortunately passed away in 2022, but his legacy and voice live on in the many books he's recorded for RNIB. And while I was playing The Code of the Woosters on RNIB Connect Radio, I gave Bruce a ring and asked him if he'd remembered when he'd recorded The Code of the Woosters.
I really don't. I recorded so many books for the RNIB in the Great Portland Street studios. I remember Alva Liddell in one studio, and I think reading so long that he and the engineer both fell asleep as the tape slipped away. In those days, we used tape. Now it's all digital, isn't it? But so many over the years, I can't remember exactly when. But to begin with, it was a very small cottage industry. There was one lady, I've forgotten her name, but there was one lady who ran it, and there were only about 10, 12 readers to begin with, and they were all very specially selected because of their clairvoices, I suppose.
Mm.
And there were, I think, 4 studios to begin with in Great Portland Street, and bit by bit it expanded and became more popular, and then, of course, you had the big library in Wembley for all the books, and it became very hugely popular, and some of the books were sold on, I think, to the BBC, as well as being heard on the RNIB library list. Eric Sykes, who was partially blind and deaf, was a great friend of mine, he listened to the RNIB books, and he said one day, "I didn't know you did these books," he said. "I'm listening to," he said, "But for Bunter." He says, "The funniest book I've ever heard." And, it really is a funny book. It's about Billy Bunter in his old age, reminiscing about all the things that he got wrong. Like, he was the one that lost the binoculars on the Titanic. And it's a very funny book. If it's still in the library, it's well worth listening to. It's called But for Bunter.
I know you've narrated a lot of H.E. Bates and a lot, as we say, of P.G. Wodehouse, which are incredible books. What was the preparation like for a book like The Code of the Woosters?
Well, it's basically pronunciation. I don't know if you still do it, but because I haven't recorded for the RNIB for a little while. I've moved out of London now. But we used to have the BBC pronunciation unit helping us with certain difficult words.
Mm.
But apart from that, it was a question of just making sure that you weren't caught out by giving a voice to the wrong character.
Now, if there's anybody listening there who's trying to put a face to your voice, it's a very recognisable face, and many people will know it from the BBC sitcom Butterflies, where you were the other man.
That's right, Leonard. He was always chasing Wendy Craig through parks and in his jogging suit and in his car with his Michael Ripper playing my chauffeur. Yes, that's right. It went on for 5 years. Brief encounter, week after week.
And to list all the books you've done for RNIB that you've narrated and are in the library would take the rest of the show. So I suggest any listeners out there go and look up Bruce Montague on the RNIB book site and see the vast array of books that are available. And I just really brought you on to say thank you for all the work you've done for RNIB and the wonderful, wonderful job. I know I'm being biased here, but I love the P.G. Wodehouse books and I love your interpretation of them. So thank you very much, and thank you very much for joining me today on Talking Books.
Well, thank you for having me.
The late, great Bruce Montague. As we said, there are a lot of books in the library narrated by Bruce. Where they join...
The Hazelbourne Ladies Motorcycle and Flying Club by Helen Simonson was donated by Bloomsbury.
In the first place, it did not seem quite right that a girl that young should be free to wander the hotel and seaside town without a chaperone. She looked respectable enough, though she was pale as alabaster and thin as a wet string. She was clothed in a brown wool dress, perhaps a bit too big, that fell decently to the ankles, and her leather boots still had a shine of newness on them. She was some sort of connection and companion to Mrs. Fogg, an old lady from a grand family in the Shires. But it seemed to Klaus Zieger that the old lady encouraged far too much independence. Since her arrival at the Meredith Hotel, the girl was always to be found tripping through the grand public rooms alone, or curled up in an armchair, deep in a book, oblivious to all. And now, with the old lady having ordered dinner in her room again, the girl wished to be seated in the grand dining room, alone.
It is the summer of 1919, and Constance Haverhill is without prospects. Now that all the men have returned from the front, she's been asked to give up her cottage and her job at the estate she helped run during the war. While she looks for a position as a bookkeeper or, horror, a governess, she's sent as a lady's companion to an old family friend who's convalescing at a seaside hotel. Despite having only weeks to find a permanent home, Constance is swept up in the social whirl of Hazelbourne-on-Sea after she rescues the local baronet's daughter, Poppy Whirl, from a social faux pas. Poppy wears trousers, operates a taxi and delivering service to employ local women, and runs a ladies' motorcycle club to which she plans to add flying lessons. She and her friends enthusiastically welcome Constance into their circle. And then there is Harris, Poppy's recalcitrant but handsome brother, a fighter pilot recently wounded in battle, who warms in Constance's presence. But things are more complicated than they seem in this sunny pocket of English high society. As the country prepares to celebrate its hard-won peace, Constance and the women of the club are forced to confront the fact that the freedoms they gained during the war are being revoked. The Hazelbourne Ladies Motorcycle Flying Club is historical fiction of the highest order, an unforgettable coming-of-age story, a tender romance, and a portrait of a nation on the brink of change.
I hoped, because it was early, she said, peering past Klaus into the high-ceilinged room, which functioned as both restaurant and ballroom. She spoke respectfully, but there was a firmness to her tone and a faint lift of the chin. A quiet corner, somewhere? Only two tables were occupied, each with a pair of elderly ladies nodding their hats at each other. The room echoed a little, silverware pinging against glass, shoes loud against the parquet floor. The tall potted palms stirred in an unknown draught, and from beyond the tall French windows came the murmur of voices from the seafront and the low booming of the sea against the pebbled shore. Later would come the dancing crowds, the loud hotel orchestra, and the crude, drunken Saturday night carousing, all things that would never have been countenanced before the war. "I'm very sorry, miss," Klaus repeated, drawing himself up. He was the lone waiter at this hour, and in the absence of the head waiter, who was having his own dinner in the kitchen, he felt keenly the need to defend the ragged standards that were left. "Can I arrange to have something sent to your room?"
"Please don't be sorry," the girl said. "We are all bound by our duties, are we not?"
She gave him a brief smile and walked away down the long marble floor of the glass-enclosed palm terrace. Her smile made him ashamed. Not answering him about the dinner tray made him irritated. Turning away, a hotel customer added a new string to the vibration of anxiety that hummed in his veins.
The Hazelbourne Ladies Motorcycle and Flying Club by Helen Simonson is read by Fiona Hardingham with the author and runs for 15 hours and 21 minutes.
New in from HarperCollins, we have Teddy by Emily Dunley.
David took me to Arthur's Prime Steaks and Seafood for our first date. I think about that night often, twisting it over in my mind like an oyster sucking on a speck of sand, trying to pick out the warning signs. But it was an ordinary evening, or at least not notably life-changing. I didn't even fall in love. I thought he was awkward and unattractive at first, with his horn-rimmed glasses and his ears that stuck out like sails from the sides of his head. They were fat and puffy, almost cauliflower ears, but David was no boxer. I don't mean to say he wasn't dangerous, just that he had a particular way he liked to fight, and it wasn't with his hands.
It is the summer of 1969, and Rome is awash with glamour and intrigue. Teddy Huntley Carlyle is fresh off a plane from Texas, with a new husband in tow and a new life on the horizon. After some wayward years of bad men and bad decisions, she promised herself a fresh start. In Rome, Teddy will be good. She will wear the right clothes and the perfect lipstick, and she will charm her husband's colleagues at the embassy. And Freddie is good, until the 4th of July, when her new life explodes with the fireworks above her head. She's caught on camera in the arms of the American ambassador just moments after spotting a man from the darkest corner of her past across the room. There it is, the evidence of her depravity on film. Trying to recover the photographs and keep her reputation intact, Teddy descends into the dark underbelly of the city. But is she in over her head?
I have to say I'm ashamed now of my first impression of him, that I judged him so harshly over something that wasn't his fault. There was plenty to judge him for later, but I didn't know it at the time. My cousin Marcia had convinced her husband, an old pal of David's from the University of Wisconsin, to give him my phone number. He was in Dallas on business for the government, apparently, having flown all the way from the American Embassy in Rome, and he didn't know anyone in town to have dinner with. Or rather, didn't know anyone aside from Marcia's husband. And Marcia, as I learned much later, found David off-putting and cold and didn't want to waste a babysitter on him. So she thought of me instead. Marcia was always trying to set me up. "You'll do great together," she said on the phone when she told me to expect his call at any minute. "You're the two most eligible spinsters I know." I was very beautiful. And I'm not being vain, you know, it's something people used to say to me. Still do, actually. So you might have thought dating would be easy for me. But everyone is beautiful in Dallas, and I was already 34. And every other man Marcia had set me up with had apparently reported after the fact that he found me to be distant and aloof and strange. A tough nut to crack. Which was a characterization that always surprised me, given that I mostly felt like I was missing my shell, leaving the tender and rumpled meat of myself out in the open for any errant squirrel. Marcia was always free with these reviews, as if I could adjust my demeanor by committee. "Loosen up a little, Ted," she'd say. "Let your hair down."
Teddy by Emily Dunley is read by Carlotta Brenton and runs for 10 hours and 54 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's show, let's return to author Jessie Sotanzo for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
So many books. Actually, most of them were by British authors. So obviously, like Roald Dahl, Enid Blyton. I read probably all of their books, and they definitely made me fall in love with writing. And I also read the Babysitter's Club series, you know. Mostly the series, you know, those were the things that I read as a child.
If you were to pick one, what would it be?
Matilda.
Matilda's parents owned quite a nice house with three bedrooms upstairs, while on the ground floor there was a dining room and a living room and a kitchen. Her father was a dealer in second-hand cars. He seemed that he did it pretty well. "Sawdust," he would say proudly, "is one of the great secrets of my success, and it costs me nothing. I get it free from the sawmill." "What do you use it for?" Matilda asked him. "Ha, ha, ha, ha," the father said. "Yeah, wouldn't you like to know? I don't see how sawdust can help you sell second-hand cars, Daddy." "That's because you're an ignorant little twit," the father said. His speech was never very delicate, but Matilda was used to it. She also knew that he liked to boast, and she would egg him on shamelessly. "You must be very clever to find a use for something that costs nothing," she said. "I wish I could do it."
"Yeah, well, you couldn't," the father said. "You're too stupid. But I don't mind telling young Mike here about it, seeing he'll be joining me in the business one day."
Ignoring Matilda, he turned to his son and said, "I'm always glad to buy a car when some fool has been crashing the gears so badly that they're all worn out and rattle like mad. I get it cheap. Then all I do is mix a lot of sawdust with the oil in the gearbox, and it runs as sweet as a nut."
"How long will it run like that before it starts rattling again?" Matilda asked him.
"Long enough for the buyer to get a good distance away," the father said, grinning. "About 100 miles.
"But that's dishonest, Daddy," Matilda said. "It's cheating."
"Well, no one ever got rich by being honest," the father said. "Customers are there to be diddled."
That's Jean Ford, reading from Matilda by Roald Dahl. Available in audio from RNIB Talking Books in both English and Welsh, and also available in Braille. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Oh my gosh, so any of Terry Pratchett's Discworld books, I absolutely adore, but especially the ones with the witches. So like I've read Witches Abroad, I think 6 times now, and I love them so much. So that's definitely my comfort go-to reread.
There was one ram-top witch who was not attending the Sabbat, which is like a night out as much as anyone else, but in this case she had a more pressing appointment, and it wasn't the kind of appointment you can put off easily. Desiderata Hollow was making her will. When Desiderata Hollow was a girl, her grandmother had given her 4 important pieces of advice to guide her young footsteps on the unexpectedly twisting pathway of life. They were: never trust a dog with orange eyebrows. always get the young man's name and address. Never get between two mirrors. And always wear completely clean underwear every day, because you never knew when you were going to be knocked down and killed by a runaway horse, and if people found you had unsatisfactory underwear on, you'd die of shame. And then Desiderata grew up to become a witch. And one of the minor benefits of being a witch is that you know exactly when you're going to die and can wear what underwear you like.
Which explains a lot about witches.
That had been 80 years earlier, when the idea of knowing exactly when you were going to die had seemed quite attractive, because secretly, of course, you knew you were going to live forever. That was then. And this was now. Forever didn't seem to last as long these days as once it did. Another log crumbled to ash in the fireplace. Desiderata hadn't bothered to order any fuel for the winter. Not much point, really. And then, of course, there was this other thing. She'd wrapped it up carefully into a long, slim package. Now she folded up the letter, addressed it, and pushed it under the string. Job done. She looked up. Desiderata had been blind for 30 years, but this hadn't been a problem. She'd always been blessed, if that was the word, with second sight. So when the ordinary eyes gave out, you just trained yourself to see into the present, which, anyway, was easier than the future. And since the eyeball of the occult didn't depend on light, you saved on candles. There was always a silver lining, if you knew where to look, in a manner of speaking.
Witches Abroad, Discworld book number 12 by Terry Pratchett, is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by Indra Verma, Peter Serafinovich, and Bill Nye.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yes, so it would be The Husband by, I think her name is Holly Gramacio. I'm probably butchering her name, but it's such a fun book. The audiobook is excellent. And it's one of those that, you know, as an author, like, it really irritated me that I didn't come up with this idea, because it was just so fun. And she just did an amazing job with it.
The second man is even taller than the first and more strongly built. He has the short cut and wavering hairline of someone who is balding young and not at peace with the fact. But he is startlingly good looking, his cheekbones sharp, his olive skin flawless, a dark green t-shirt fitting him closely. She says, looking at his face and then his forearms. His forearms? He, too, is wearing a wedding ring. Is that for me? He says, nodding at the mug. A slight accent. Turkish, perhaps? The mug in her hands is yellow with thin black lines. Yes? Great, he says. His eyelashes are dark. She doesn't move. Are you okay? The maybe Turkish, gratuitously handsome husband says after a moment. His immaculate eyebrows furrow in concern. She looks up at the attic, searching for Michael. Then back at the landing. Its walls, usually grey, more recently blue, are white. She steps backwards and peers into the living room. The wedding picture is gone. You're not still hungover, are you? The man asks. No, she lies and switches her focus back to him. Were you just in the attic? What? Yes, you saw me. Was anyone else there? Where? She looks at the dark square. Up there? Is Mike... was there anyone in the attic? Like a squirrel? Mice? I don't think so. Do you want me to check? He stands, one hand on the ladder, teetering between irritation and concern. The mug is still warm in her hands. Yes, she says. Are you sure you're okay? Yes, if you could check, please. The husband tightens his shapely lips and climbs part way back up the ladder, and then continues, up, up, all the way in, his bare feet, uncalloused, perfectly formed, disappearing before her eyes. There's a moment of movement and brightness above her, like a flash of sunlight through train windows and a sharp crackle. A moment later, a blue furry slipper emerges from the trapdoor, and another. Huh. The third husband is less attractive than the first two, with a rectangular head and sunburn across his pale nose. His red-brown hair sticks out at all angles. She is still holding the mug, it's now pink. Her hands are hot. She shifts her grip. His slippers have purple spots and black claws, and she thinks they may be Monsters, Inc.-themed. We really should clean it out up there. From his voice, he is perhaps Welsh? She's not sure. He dumps a bag on the ground and, without waiting for a reply, he goes back up, climbs halfway in, brings down another bag he must have left by the hatch, and heads up again, all the way this time. Another moment of light, bright and then dark, and a sound, a fuzz. And moments later, and it's almost not a surprise, this time, another new man calls out.
The Husbands by Holly Gramazio is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books as narrated by Miranda Raisin. And once again, Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer. That we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.